This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. This week on In the Garden with UC Master Gardeners, the subject is Urban Forest. I am Ann Liu, University of California Master Gardeners and KUCI staff host, and I feel lucky and excited to have Michael Pallett with us today as my guest. He is an expert in the field of growing trees in a city setting. He is a board-certified master arborist with utility and municipal specialties, as well as a certified tree care safety professional and a certified wildlife protector. He currently works as area manager with West Coast Arborists Incorporated and oversees municipal contracts in San Diego County. Welcome to In the Garden Show, Michael.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Today's show is about urban forest. Is this a new term?
No, it's not a new term, but it's a term that's starting to gain some momentum.
What does it mean to you, and how did you get interested in the subject?
Well, what it means to me is the recognition of trees in urban settings and the benefits that those trees provide. And how I got interested is I'm actually originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I came out to California in 2000. And just growing up in the forest that I grew up in just naturally kind of drew me to this field.
And that's why I even chose this as a topic for In the Garden. I love trees. And with the expanding cities, we are having fewer and fewer trees and less opportunity for the newer generations to actually be in a forest setting. And so the idea of an urban forest sounds so inviting.
Yeah, it really is something to not lose sight of, that we do indeed live in an urban forest. You mentioned the expansion, the urban sprawl, the things that are happening. Trees are oftentimes sacrificed for that, and it's at a loss, and it's unfortunate. And there's even our children are having challenges finding nature. There's a saying, it's a nature deficit disorder. It's actually a book written by Richard Loeve, The Last Child in the Forest or in the Woods or something like that. But it's a phenomenon that is affecting our experiences with nature.
That sounds like a good read for me. Nature deficit disorder. I can see that being an issue, since I feel so much better when I'm under a tree. I could just feel the coolness. There's something bonding me physically with nature. And I think if we didn't have more trees, we would feel very deprived of something.
Right. In fact, there's been a lot of research specifically to how trees have a somewhat of a healing property. They've done studies that show that medical recovery times are faster when you have trees outside your windows. There's even been studies that show that actually grades improve with campuses that have trees on them versus blighted, you know, asphalt-lined campuses. So that's just a couple examples of the healing and mental properties that we get from trees.
I love that. I would like to read more books about that. I think the topic is growing, isn't it? The study in that.
It is.
This show will be an introduction to urban forestry then, covering four general areas. First, choosing the right tree for the right place. Second, planting the tree and getting it established. Third, pruning trees properly. And fourth, the role of city tree ordinances. Michael actually teaches regularly. He teaches an arborist class at MiraCosta College in Oceanside that covers these four topics. That includes covering these four topics. So we're in for a powerful, fact-filled interview with you. We'll not only focus on our home gardens, but gain a better understanding of trees growing in our public space around us too. Let's begin with the first one. Choosing the right tree for the right place. How is this a cornerstone consideration when planning a landscape?
It's really a critical piece of decision-making when it comes to trees. The average lifespan of an urban tree is 8 years.
Mm.
8 years,
that's
which is
not
pretty
very
astronomical.
Long.
Yeah, it's pretty eye-opening when you hear that, or ear-opening, I should say.
Why is that?
Well, so a lot of it goes back to the wrong tree in the wrong place. We plant these trees that outgrow their areas, that have infrastructure damage that occurs, or that don't get water. Not getting water is one of the hugest factors to young trees failing.
Mm.
But a lot of the thinking about trees as to what they're going to look like at maturity is not something that takes place frequently enough. And when we do that, we tend to lead trees to failure. There was a lot of trees that are currently causing a lot of problems with infrastructure that were planted, 20 years ago, that were the wrong tree in the wrong place. And now there's a lot of money spent to try and preserve them in their state. And realistically, again, going back to the right tree in the right place, if it's suitable, it's not going to require a heavy level of maintenance to keep it where it's at, because we selected the right tree.
And you'll be letting us know more about the right trees for Southern California cities?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of varieties that are successful and have drought tolerance is one of the biggest things. One thing to think about, especially, is to consider utility lines. That's one of the biggest challenges in urban settings is, the right tree in the right place. Thinking about the overhead utilities, no taller than about 25 feet is what we're looking for trees at their maturity, not just when we plant them, but when they mature, what is going to be their maximum growth height? And there's a lot of resources that we can look at. There's a website that I refer. It's selecttree.org. That is a really good website that I refer people to look up attributes about trees. But specifically power lines, also thinking about underground utilities is also a consideration. So definitely looking up and thinking about what's below ground, and then obviously looking around for other infrastructure potential conflicts.
Especially recently with our wildfires and our forever Santa Ana winds, trees are always becoming a danger to safety.
They can be. I'll say that if you maintain a tree, you definitely keep trees in a lot safer condition, including the early structural pruning to establish and get rid of some problems that can become big problems later on in the tree's life. So if you maintain your trees, you definitely can have safer trees, but obviously all trees do pose some level of risk. But it's your due diligence and maintenance and also selecting the right tree for that spot that'll help with the longevity and the safety of the tree and yourself.
Now, choosing the right tree for the right spot in consideration of the surrounding structures, can you describe a little bit about what that means?
So, I mean, in an urban city setting, we have the sidewalk issues. So we have the curb and gutter adjacent to the street, and then we have that sidewalk, that little strip of grass there. They call that a parkway. So if you have a very small parkway, you obviously don't want to pick a tree that's going to have, be renowned for having root invasive issues. So that's one example of an infrastructure. Thinking from the private side of things, you have a backyard, you have the foundation of your home, you have your neighbor's property where the canopy can, effectively grow over the fence, things like that. So you want to consider, again, what the tree is going to look like at maturity, what are its growth characteristics, is it a messy tree, is it a fruiting tree? Is it a tree that's renowned for being root invasive? So these are all questions you kind of want to ask yourself to make sure you're putting the right tree in the right place.
And some trees, like you mentioned already about their invasiveness and their root growth and how it can interfere with utility lines and such, these trees that fall under those categories are basically trees to avoid.
Right, right. I mean, not necessarily to avoid, but it just... in the right place. That's why we say the right tree in the right place.
Far away from the sidewalk.
Right, far away from the sidewalk. But obviously, it's nice to have, in urban forestry, you want to have diversity. It's becoming more and more critical to have diversity. So trees that achieve the heights that are suitable under power lines, and lots of trees that don't, trees that are going to achieve really tall heights. It's a good thing to help an urban forest thrive when you have size diversity, species diversity, age diversity, all these considerations really lend to having better success for your trees for a variety of reasons.
I see. Now, you've provided me a list of Southern California trees suitable under utility lines. Where can the listeners, the public, access a list such as this?
You know, your local utilities typically have a list of trees that they feel are suitable for under their power lines. I know in San Diego, San Diego Gas and Electric has a pretty comprehensive list. But there's a couple really nice varieties of trees that are suitable, like an African sumac tree. The botanical name is Ruslantia. That tree is an evergreen tree, very, very drought tolerant, doesn't achieve more than 25 feet in height. And as far as root invasiveness, it's very low. Another one, just kind of looking at this list, the gold medallion tree is a really pretty tree, produces a really nice yellow flower. Has these long seed pods on it. And again, just suitability for under power lines is a nice one there. It's a semi-deciduous, so it does lose some of its leaves, but really nice tree there as well.
Just a few weeks ago, we had a podcast about Cal Fire trees recommended for having a defensible space, trees that are not fire hazards. Now, I see on this list you have eucalyptus.
Mm-hmm.
This species, eucalyptus
torquata.
Uh-huh. Do the oils of this eucalyptus have danger for fire?
Being from San Diego, I've dealt with quite a bit of fires, and we actually saw a lot of I know eucalyptus have a bad rep, but a lot of eucalyptus actually saved trees, and it was the eucalyptus trees that were healthily maintained. So really, when you have a tree that isn't maintained, you've got lots of deadwood in it, it's a kind of a heavy canopy, it's more prone to ignition versus a healthy tree that's been had its deadwood removed and had its canopy thinned out a little bit. But what we saw in San Diego was scenarios where those trees acted as ember catchers as opposed to going to a home. So it was beneficial to actually have, some examples of eucalyptus trees that were there to prevent fires.
That's interesting. So a property owner can refer to their utilities, to their utility company to get advice as to whether those trees would be suitable under utility lines?
Yes. Yeah. The utilities have a big benefit in getting the right tree in the right place, because what's not there, they have to maintain on a high frequency. So they like these trees.
And at the same time, Cal Fire also provides a list of trees that they recommend. And so maybe the homeowner can do some research in considering both concerns.
Right. Absolutely. Good idea.
Now, many times the root area is larger than the branch spread above ground.
Right. A lot of people think it mirrors, tree roots mirror the top of the tree underground. And I want to go on record, they do not. Tree roots need available oxygen and available moisture, and that's typically found in the upper 18 inches of soil. So if you can envision a tree, the canopy of it nice and pretty, but below ground, it's literally pretty flat and far reaching and spreading. And again, some trees have a more notorious root spreading capacity than others, but it's not a mirror of the above ground. And it goes well beyond what we call the drip line or the outer edge of the canopy. Lots of trees go further and further than that.
And if the roots are not well cared for and there's not enough oxygen and water, these trees can weaken and become real hazards at the time of drought and heavy rain.
Right. So what you have over time is root recession does occur, when there's a drought condition. So you can get root recession. So your roots will recede closer back in towards the tree itself, and the feeder roots can die off. But, if they get irrigated back up, they can reproduce.
So let's talk a little bit more in a little bit under the second category. Let's talk a little bit about maintenance of established trees, especially with the drought conditions that we've had in California. Now, a little bit more about choosing the right tree for the right place. Now, when you consider planting a tree, you have to know where those underground lines are.
Right. We're big fans of Dig Alert. It's a process where you can call. It's an underground service alert. And what it is all the local utilities are required to come identify where all their potential conflicts are. And typically it's about 48 hours in advance of you digging. I will say this is typically just for right-of-way or public property. They typically won't go on private property to provide this service, but you could certainly call them and see where the utilities come into your property, and then that can help you with your decision-making. But obviously, for digging can be dangerous, so as a rule of thumb, it's really good to try and find out what's below ground before you start digging.
That's really helpful for me to know, because right in front of our home, we have our lines, and we often have trees. My neighbor and me have trees that have roots that might be interfering with these lines, and so I didn't know there was a public access.
Right. Well, it's okay. It's more the digging part. Once a tree gets in the ground, a lot of times it's the digging itself is where somebody could hit something while they're digging is really what that's for. So if you're gonna be planting a tree, it's really good to know what's there. And then obviously, if you're going to plant on top of a big utility, it'd be good to know that as well.
So let's say the source again.
It's the Dig Alert. It's 1-800-227-2600. And it's the Underground Service Alert Program.
Underground Service Alert Program.
Yeah, USA.
Or Dig Alert. And I guess the public can just find that online and find the number that way.
Yep. And they would require information like the location. And sometimes you can even schedule a meet and mark is what we call it, where the utilities will all show up and you can point out where you're going to be digging and they can identify what potential conflicts there might be.
Before we leave this area, let's talk a little bit about trees known for root invasiveness.
Yeah, there's a few on the list like I mentioned in the beginning earlier about trees that were planted 20 years ago were challenged with trying to preserve them because we love the benefits they provide, but the infrastructure damage that's associated with them is challenging. And I see a few on this list. Ficus in general are pretty renowned for having root invasiveness issues. Definitely ficus in the right scenario are fantastic. Give them a wide berth, give them a nice open planting area. They're more likely to, you're not going to have to deal with the root issues, but in an urban setting and in that planter strip, planting a ficus, you're going to have some infrastructure damage. Carobs is another one on the list that's that way. Coral trees.
Oh, yeah. I see a lot of coral in my area, and they just bring up that sidewalk and make it a menace for people with wheelchairs and walking difficulty.
Right. And then California peppers is another one on there, I see.
And coast live oak.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a favorite tree for many.
Right. And it's a great tree. All these trees are great trees. Just again, right tree in the right place. Let's find the right place for those trees.
And we do not want them in areas where their roots can invade and cause safety hazards.
Right. And help them live longer. Again, planting them in a place where they're not going to have their roots cut off or heavy maintenance just to keep them where they are, they'll live a lot longer because of that.
Let's talk a little bit more about the overhead utility lines. What height is ideal for under utility lines? I think you mentioned it a little bit already.
Yeah. So
let's do that again.
A maximum mature height at 25 feet. That's the thinking we want to have. Obviously, we put it in the ground. When it's a small tree, it's not that big of a deal. But what's it going to look like at maturity is the question we want to ask. So directly under power lines is 25 feet. As you progress outside of even thinking to the side of power lines, it'd be nice to have trees that don't get taller than about 40 feet. And those are, if in the event the tree falls over, will it impact the power lines to its side?
Now, how far apart should these trees be?
In urban forestry, as a kind of rule of thumb, it's about every 30 feet off center is kind of, and you can stagger them, but you want to let canopies have the full ability to develop. So if you have them too close together, then they're kind of competing for sunlight and they might not grow in the most ideal way. But about 30 feet off center is about the urban forest standard.
So overall, if we plan before we plant, it can ensure that our property value will go up because it enhances the property. It's yep. a lot prettier.
Yep, exactly. Actually, there's some statistics on that. A nice mature tree can add about 10% to your home's value. So you do the math on some of the homes in Orange County. It's a significant asset if you have a nice, mature, healthy tree.
Let's go to the second area. But before we do, I want to remind our listeners, this is the In the Garden show produced by UC Master Gardeners. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Ann Liu interviewing Michael Pallett, certified arborist, board certified arborist, on the topic urban forests. Now we know choosing the right tree for the right place is only the beginning step. Let's move on to the second area, planting the tree and getting it established. Trees are expensive and take a long time to grow, so it's important to get them installed and established in the best way possible. How do you do that, even with drought conditions?
Well, we've done step one, which was identify and select the right tree for the right place. So that's step one. Now that we've made the determination as to which tree we want, you need to think about the tree as a lifelong investment. You know, what you're about to do will potentially and hopefully be there for the rest of your life. And, you know, hopefully your kids and your grandkids will get a chance to see that tree. So obviously making sure the location's clear, the care that you're going to provide after it's planted is planned for. And just you want to consider those things.
Now, this is a great time to consider planting a tree or a shrub, because it's coming into the dormant season in the fall. As the weather is cooling, the leaves drop. This is a good time to plant a tree, or in early spring.
Right. Yeah, you definitely want to start to think about it now. You could certainly plant year-round, but when you do plant year-round, the biggest thing is water. You might have to change or modify your watering plan if you're planting in the middle of summer, but it can be done.
And where you buy the tree, the nursery can make recommendations on how to begin watering mm-hmm. and then how to ease it off.
That's right.
Before planting the tree, we consider the correct species, right?
Right. Yep.
And what it will look like when it's all grown. You said no more than 25 feet.
For trees that are under power lines.
Under power lines, right. Up to 40 feet. And
for the side,
about
right.
30 feet from the center for yep. each tree so they don't compete. Now, we talked about dig alert mm-hmm. to be sure that when you plant the tree, you don't go into the power lines, utility lines.
Yep. And then they obviously, you know, when you're digging the hole, you want to plan your tools. Thinking about what tools you're going to use to dig, depending on the size of the tree, but obviously shovels. There's a tool called a digging bar, which is a little heavy, I think it's made of steel bar that's helps for rough digging. So if you have a area where it's challenging to dig, it'd be really useful to have a tool called a digging bar.
Now, how deep should one dig?
So it's based on the container. So if we're selecting trees, I mean, out here in California, we have containerized grown trees. So we have a 15-gallon, which is like a 5-gallon, like the Home Depot bucket, roughly sized tree. The caliper of that is about 3/4 to about 1.5 inches is what it should be. One of the things about selecting trees at the nursery is to really look at the caliper of your tree compared to the container that it's in. There's a standard called the ANSI, American National Standards Institute, Z60.1 nursery standards. And those specify, based on the container that the tree's in, what the caliper should be. If your caliper is really large, so say, for example, that Home Depot size bucket, and you have a caliper of your tree 2 to 3 inches in diameter, some people view that as a good deal. Hey, I got a big tree for this price. But the problem is you inherit root girdling issues. The tree's been in the container for too long. Mm. And what happens is the roots hit the side of that plastic container and turn inward, and it just basically becomes this girdled root mass mess, which when you get it out to the urban landscape can be a challenge for not only establishment but future safety. That tree can fail later and because it really doesn't get an established root system. So it's really good to look at the caliper of your tree in association with the container size that you're dealing with. And it the bigger the container, the larger the caliper can move.
Let's go back a little bit and explain to the listener what you mean by the caliper of the tree.
So we're talking about the diameter, and in nursery standards, it's about, you're looking at the tree coming out of the container, the stem itself. We want to roughly measure the diameter of that stem as it's coming out.
Where it touches the soil?
Go about 6 inches above the soil, measure that, and where that is essentially, we call that the caliper. So you're measuring that, and if it's a, we call it a 15-gallon size container, you're looking at about 3/4 to 1.5 inch caliper of diameter right there. If it's larger than that, there's a higher propensity for having root issues later on.
I see. And by checking the tree root when it comes out of the pot, I think it's important. Some nurseries may put a very young tree into a larger pot so they can charge more.
Right.
I've had that experience.
Yes.
And then you have the opposite where the tree has been in the pot and you have the root girdling. Now, let's say I'm unfortunate to have a tree with a root girdling. Can I clip some of the roots to loosen up the root tightness?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, it's a pretty tough scenario to not find a tree that doesn't have some level of girdling roots. It's just it's kind of the nature of our economy. The economy's doing a little bit better, but when the economy slowed down, the trees don't get the memo that their roots are supposed to slow down. But yes, you can go in and cut where you see roots turning back in on the tree itself. You can go in and cut those, especially when the tree's young. Obviously, when the tree's more mature, this is a little bit more of a challenge. But yeah, you can cut some of those roots to free up some of that tangled mess.
And just to ease it out softly and to kind of like spread out the roots?
Yeah, spread them out. You know, obviously when we go through the process of starting to plant, when we dig, you know, let me start talking a little bit about this process, about installation. So when you plant a tree, you're going to dig the hole at least 2 times as wide as the root ball, maybe even 3. When you do that, you're loosening up soil to help to create an environment that's suitable for those roots that you're spreading apart to migrate into the native soil. So when you're digging beyond the container, you're helping the tree for future root development.
Now, should it be planted on some kind of we have a hole. Should I have a mound of soil on the bottom of that hole and have the roots spread out around that mound?
So no, if you plant bare root stock, you would do it that way. But most of the trees we're talking about are the container grown California type trees. Mm-hmm. So no, we wouldn't do a mound in that case, no.
So just have the hole. Mm-hmm. How much do I amend the soil?
So when you say amend, what do you mean?
Do I plant it just in the native soil, or can I?
So I'm a big believer in not starting off a tree with fertilizers. The way I view it is we want this tree to acclimate as quickly as possible to the native conditions. When we introduce fertilizers and tabs and things like that, essentially we're creating a false environment, which can delay establishment. So water is critical. I'm a big fan of using mulch. But as far as adding amendment or fertilizers, I'd prefer to try and let the tree just get acclimated to the conditions that are there as quickly as possible.
What kind of mulch would I use?
I'm a big fan of the organic wood chip type mulch, even having some leafy material almost straight out of a chipper truck if you can arrange it. But that stuff helps, you know, break down pretty good. One big thing when you do mulch, you know, you want it to be about 2 to 4 inches in thickness, and you got to make sure you keep it away from that lower trunk area. You don't want to mound it up against, you know, we call it a mulch volcano. We don't want to do a mulch volcano where we're mounding mulch up against the trunk. We want to keep it about, you know, 1 to 2 inches away from the trunk, that lower root collar area. And really, it's just for the, you know, as it breaks down, it'll feed those roots.
So just to be clear to our listeners out there, we're not talking about putting mulch into the hole. He's talking about putting mulch on top of the soil around the newly planted tree.
Good point. Thank you for...
And not to have the mulch within 2 inches of the actual the tree itself.
Right. Let me go back. So you dig the hole, you place the tree in the hole. When you're placing the tree in the depth of the hole is based on wherever the root flare is. And when I'm talking about the root flare, it's where the roots originate off of the stem. So wherever that is, we typically want to have that about 1 to 1.5 inches above grade. So when you're digging, you're kind of measuring from that point as far as the depth. So we're going 2 to 3 times the root ball in the width, and we're going to where that root flare is for the depth, placing it in the hole. You're going to do your backfill process. We like to make a nice soil berm around the tree itself, and that's where you would lay that mulch. And that berm is meant to retain, have the water be directed right to the root ball when you, when you're watering. You're filling up that berm and letting it trickle down into the tree.
Very good. Michael, I need to take a few minutes for station identification. This is the In the Garden show produced by UC Master Gardeners. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Ann Liu, interviewing Michael Pallett on the topic urban forest. He is an expert in the field of growing trees in a city setting. He is a board certified master arborist with utility and municipal specialties, as well as a certified tree care safety professional and a certified wildlife protector. He currently works as area manager with West Coast Arborists Incorporated and oversees municipal contracts in San Diego County. We have just covered how to establish, plant and establish the tree. Before we move into our third area, let's finish up. After the tree is planted, supporting the tree, and you want to talk a little bit about supporting the tree and avoiding tree rings?
Yeah, so obviously the staking system that you use, when you purchase a tree in the landscape, it's going to have what we call a nursery stake, or when you purchase it from the nursery, it comes what's called a nursery stake that is basically attached to the trunk. What that's for is for developing trees in a nursery. It's really critical to take that off once you get it to the landscape where it's going to live. It's almost like leaving a cast on too long. As soon as you plant it, take that off. And then we use a double stake system. You know, you can use a set of rubber ties, but have your stakes, two stakes just outside the root ball and tied together, holding the stem. You want to have some mobility on your tree, though. You don't want to have the two stakes holding the tree up completely. You want to have your tree have some flexibility, because that actually helps the roots get developed quicker.
And the point of having two allows it to move a little bit with the wind?
Right, right. You do want mobility.
That's important. And to loosen the, to use what kind of tie?
I'm a big fan of the rubber ties. It's a rubber tie system that can be twisted and kind of tied and linked together between each other and nailed into the stakes.
Now, I'm always amazed at how fast plants grow. I've seen this happen in my own garden. If I don't keep an eye on how fast it's growing, that rubber tie can form a can cut into the bark of the tree.
Right. So it really, it's ideal to get the stakes off as soon as possible. I've seen trees be in the ground for 2 months, and I go and check them, and they don't need the stakes anymore. Really, the best way to tell whether or not a tree needs stakes is to literally grab the trunk of the tree, and you pull on it and rock it back and forth. And if you see the root, if you look at the ground while you're doing that, and the ground is moving as you're doing that, then the tree needs to have its stakes left on.
Very good.
If you grab it and just the tree is moving and no ground is moving, it's time to get those stakes off. And that can happen relatively quick. There used to be a mentality that you need to keep stakes on for a year, but the sooner the better. The sooner you get them off, the better for the tree.
Ah, okay. Now we're ready to go into our third area, pruning trees properly. Some basics are first to know something about tree architecture before cutting off branches. Shall we start with that?
Sure, yeah. It's really important to have a reasoning behind your pruning cuts. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of structural pruning. So when the tree is young, you can see the defective problems at that time, but it takes an educated eye to catch them. And a lot of times in the landscape, the big colossal failures from mature trees were problems that could have been fixed with a pair of hand loppers when the tree was young. So it's really important to look at the structure, to start to establish a strong central leader, and work from that, basically trying to identify branches that are competing with that strong central leader and suppressing them or completely eliminating them to help the tree develop in an upward, upright fashion.
That is really, really key. As I walk through my neighborhood, I can see trees that have been pruned incorrectly. Their central stem has competing branches, so there's not enough connective tissue between the branches, and so there's just too much stress at one joint. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have one of the most common failure points in trees. They call it codominant stems with included bark. It's kind of technical terminology, but basically that those tight crotched scenarios that get end weight and they split out. What happens is those two stems that are competing with this at the same connection point, and as they continue to grow in their diameter, they're going to continue to compress and push against each other. And it's just a matter of time where in some scenarios they can split. I've seen plenty of trees that do have this inclusion that seem to be okay at the moment, but those actively splitting ones are the ones that can be really scary.
And that's really something important to deal with when the tree is young, as you say.
Absolutely, yeah.
The first 3 years.
Right, the first 3 years. And there's a lot of perceptions that anybody can trim the young trees. And like I mentioned, it's the experienced, trained people who see the defects that can make those cuts. That's why I'm a big fan of make sure you have certified arborists and certified tree workers maintaining your trees. Because I hate to say it, but landscapers aren't, their traditions are not trained in arboriculture the way that a focused, you know, tree care company is. So it's really important to put the tools in the hands of the people who are educated to make those cuts instead of just cutting for the sake of cutting.
And early on, when you have a certified arborist looking at the tree, they can advise you in ways that can save you lots of money because it's being taken care of when the tree is young.
Absolutely. Yeah, one example is, like I said, you could do structural pruning with a pair of hand loppers versus 10, 15 years down the road. Now we're looking at massive chainsaws and having to fix structural problems that make the tree look unbalanced and crazy when we're done just because it wasn't fixed when it was a young tree.
Now, for the general public, for them to find a good certified arborist, what do you recommend?
The International Society of Arboriculture has a good website, a Find an Arborist website that you can go to that, and that's a good resource.
And you mentioned ANSI. How is that different? ANSI has tree care, pruning, and safety standards for trees. ISA has best management practices for tree planting. What is the difference between that?
So the ANSI is the American National Standards Institute. The ANSI accreditation group does a lot of industry, not just tree care, but multiple industries throughout America. And they have standards specifically for tree care pruning, and that's the ANSI A300 tree pruning standards. And then the ANSI Z133, it's actually 0.1 standards, are for tree care safety. So those are what Cal OSHA monitoring job sites is looking for, is to see that staff is following safety protocols in dealing with arboriculture. It's a high risk type of work, and obviously that's why these standards are in place, is to help reduce that risk.
And ISA?
Is the International Society of Arboriculture, and they're the ones who developed the credential for certified arborists. Like, I'm a board certified master arborist, and they're the ones who created the exam and help monitor the industry for that. And then they also have a lot of educational materials, including best management practice books, including ones for tree pruning, tree planting, all sorts of really good information, field guide books.
And that would be friendly to the general public?
Yes, it would, yes.
How would they get that?
You can go to the ISA's website, or you can even go, there's a Western chapter of the ISA. That website is wcisa.net, and that's a really good website for arborist information.
Say that again, please, for the ones who have not heard that before.
Okay. It's CISA.net.
And you can find best management practices for tree pruning there, as well as find sources for books.
Right, including the Arborist Study Guide, too, which is a good resource.
Oh, that would be helpful. I think that ISA would be a wonderful source for managing your tree pruning, and I think that would be good to look at, as well as our website, uccemg.com. If you have some specific questions, you have a problem with a tree in your yard, let's say you're not sure about topping off a tree, I'll have you talk a little bit about tree topping in a minute. You can go on our hotline. Our Master Gardener hotline is hotline at mgorange.ucanr.edu, and you can ask specific questions, and more than likely our Master Gardeners would consider some of the research and advice given out by the ISA. How about tree topping before we move on to the last area, Michael?
Yeah, so tree topping is probably the worst thing you can do to a tree, okay. At least a tree that you want to keep.
Let's talk about what it is and why it's so bad.
So tree topping is essentially making cuts in the middle of branches, as opposed to cutting back to lateral branches. So we're basically it looks like a hat rack. We're basically stubbing every branch on a tree, is what we call topping.
I just saw that as I was going down a European river cruise. They were just making lollipop trees.
Right. There is a style of pruning called pollarding, which is a little bit different than topping. It's essentially topping over many, many years to create these knotted heads. But that's different than what I'm describing here. Topping is what happens when you top a tree is the leaves are the food factories for the tree. When you top it, you're basically taking away its food source. You're also structurally devastating a tree because you're going to get reactions. So for every action, there's a reaction. You're going to get multiple shoots that arise from each one of those topping cuts, and each one of them is going to be weakly attached and competing for that same connection point. So the structure is devastated, the health of the tree is devastated, the susceptibility to decay and pest invasions is increased. So it's just a really big no-no to not top trees. Some people think, oh, that tree's too tall, we need to do something. You can do what's called a crown reduction, which is a proper methodology for reducing the height of a tree. And that is by pruning back to lateral branches that are at least one-third the size of the parent branch. So it's a method of reducing the tree. I go back to the beginning of this with the right tree in the right place. If you have to shrink your tree down, you've selected the wrong tree for that spot. And, you know, it's something to think about, so you don't have to spend a lot of money reducing the height of your tree in the future.
But if you're stuck with a tree that's too tall and growing in the wrong spot, but you're not going to remove the tree, you can reduce the tree by a third every year?
Not a third. You can reduce back to a lateral branch that's a third. What you want to do is, if you were looking to reduce the overall height of your tree, I would suggest doing it in a phased manner to keep the trees healthier. Again, the leaves are the food factories for the tree. If we were to go in and make drastic cuts all at once, you're going to put the tree into a reactionary point where it's very stressed, open up susceptibility to decay and pest invasions. What I would suggest is over a series of years, you do a gradual reduction to get it to a height that you're a little bit more comfortable with. Not all at once, though. If your goal is to keep your tree healthy, do it in a phased approach where you're, 5 to maybe 10 feet a year, depending on how tall your tree is. But I'd say no more than, 5% of the height be reduced per year until you get it to the spot where you'd like it to be.
And it's also very important to work with clean tools. As Michael was mentioning about how improper pruning can introduce disease.
Yeah, there's certain species, though, that are more renowned for that. In general, you don't necessarily have to sterilize your tools. It's really the Canary Island date palms is an example. They get a fungus called Fusarium, which can spread from tools that aren't cleaned. That's pretty much the most common one is that one. I would say that's for treatment of your tools.
I see. Well, I think we have finished pruning trees. Is there anything else you want to say about pruning trees?
Yeah, you know, when I mentioned we keep talking about young trees, but in general for mature trees, really you don't want to over thin. Really, you know, the standards are you should, you know, not really take out more than 15 to 20% live foliage. Again, thinking about the tree's health, the leaves are the food factors for the tree. In general, mature trees, just focus on deadwood, diseased branches, and really keep it minimalistic. The trees that are mature, a lot of their energy is really directed towards holding themselves up. So they're not capable of handling significant wounds and the potential spread of decay that would come from that. So if you really want to preserve mature, healthy trees, just focus on deadwood and minimize your thinning to about 15 to 20%.
And where to actually make the cut. Want to talk about the branch collar?
Yeah, so when you're making your cut, it's going to be a three-step cut. Your first cut is always going to be an undercut. And the reason we do that is if you don't make your undercut and you cut from the top, the branch weight as it falls, as the branch starts to fall, it's going to peel that bark and end up stripping the bottom, you know, all the way down to the stem sometimes. So it's really important to make your first cut, you know, an undercut, you know, just a couple inches in, and then your top cut just outside that. Now we're going to take that whole limb off, essentially going to cut, you know, just a little bit above where you just made your bottom cut. The branch will fall off and you're going to have what's left is a stub. And what we do is we want to clean up that stub by pruning back just outside the branch bark ridge. There's a little bit of a visible ridge on most trees. Some trees it's a little less visible, but a little bit of a visible ridge there of stem tissue that we don't want to cut off. We actually want to cut just outside of that. And when we do that properly, the tree will actually callus over the wound. So that's really what we're trying to do is to prune in a way that the trees will close over their wounds. Otherwise, you can have decay get spread. Palm trees do not have the capability of doing this. Really only shade trees and pine trees are capable of this. But palm trees, which are monocots, don't have the ability to callus over their wounds.
These cuts are really important to do so we leave no stubs.
Right. No stubs, no tears, no saw rash. You can tell when somebody kind of goes out of control with a chainsaw and they run up and down the side of the tree. You can see where the tree got injured. And then no lion's tailing. Lion's tailing is a big no-no. Basically stripping out the inside and leaving all the weight on the far end of a branch, it leads to branch failures and torsion cracks and things like that. So it's really important to try and preserve some of that interior growth. And again, if you're sticking with the rule of thumb of 15 to 20%, foliage reduction, you're more likely to not end up lion's tailing.
We're doing really well. We've covered three areas, and we are left with the final area, the role of city tree ordinances. Before that, let me do another ID. This is the In the Garden show produced by UC Master Gardeners. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Ann Liu, interviewing Michael Pallett, board-certified master arborist with utility and municipal specialties. This show's topic is urban forests. All right, our final topic, the role of tree ordinances.
Yep.
This is your specialty.
Yeah. So dealing with, I deal with a lot of public agencies, and one of the best ways that trees are protected is through tree ordinances.
Now, there are three categories?
Yeah, there's the street tree ordinance, which primarily covers, you know, planting and removals of trees within the public right-of-way. And then there's a tree protection ordinance, which are directed at providing protection for native trees or trees with historical significance. And then there's also a view ordinance designed to help resolve conflicts between property owners that result when trees block views or sunlight.
Now, what makes some ordinances strong and some weak?
So really is it supported, you know, do you have community support for your ordinance is really what helps to strengthen them. You know, realistically, every person in a city is a potential stakeholder for urban forests. So having their understanding and their buy-in will really help strengthen an ordinance, because if nobody's reporting the negative things that are happening, then it's really not that effective of an ordinance.
How is the ordinance enforced?
So a lot of it's within code of a lot of cities where, you know, potentially police can do citations. You know, cities can take legal action for damages done to public trees and things like that. So it's typically through code enforcement is where majority of ordinances are enforced through.
Tree City USA and National Arbor Day. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Tree City USA is a program through the National Arbor Day Foundation, which helps cities to establish standards for their trees, including allocation of funds for maintenance, development of a tree board or a department, having a tree care ordinance, and then also doing an Arbor Day observance. Those are the basic four criteria in order to become a Tree City USA, which is a nationwide program that helps to cities to keep these things in place, because it's if you don't do this on an annual basis, you can lose that status.
I love that. I wonder if Irvine is a tree city.
Yes, they are.
It is.
Yes, they are, yes.
Just in this Southern California area, is it pretty common?
I would say it's probably about 60% of the cities are a Tree City USA.
And has the number, the percentage been growing?
Yeah, it's been growing, and going back to the beginning of this, what is an urban forest, that the recognition is really starting to get a foothold. A lot of cities have climate action plans, and within their climate action plans are these components of doing tree planting and, you know, really jumping on the bandwagon of the benefits that trees provide, including carbon sequestration, which is a really huge benefit that trees provide. So with that momentum, there's a lot more Tree City USAs that are being developed.
Can you tell me a little bit what that means?
Carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. So essentially, when we take a tree that has to be removed for the right reasons, defective or whatever the case may be, instead of chipping it up and having it chipping it up or making it into firewood, we preserve that wood. So for example, we're sitting here at a wooden desk here. This wood is being preserved, so that carbon is being sequestered. So instead of it being released into the atmosphere, the trees can absorb that carbon, and if it's repurposed and reused in an urban wood way, my company, West Coast Arborist, actually has an active wood mill. We actually secure quite a bit of lumber from municipal trees so that we're not releasing the carbon into the atmosphere. We're securing it.
I didn't know that. Right now, that there is an international conference happening in Germany for climate change. And one of the things they have for view is a tree made out of different lumber pieces. So it's a whole tree created with different scraps of wood.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah, Cal Fire actually has grants for this securing of lumber. They realize their money comes from cap and trade funds, and those funds have to go towards projects that that sequester carbon, whether it's tree planting or the case of securing lumber, securing the carbon through urban lumber.
Interesting. So even after the tree is cut down, the lumber, the wood, can continue to have positive change in our climate.
Another benefit that trees provide.
What a big message that is.
Absolutely.
And that helps with climate change, the heating of the earth.
That's right. That's right. So if we can find homes for the wood, one of the biggest challenges with urban wood is that we compete with graded lumber. So it's really, we're trying to develop markets that urban wood can really be sold in, because it is a little bit of a challenge. There's a lot of we're securing a lot of lumber, but it's finding projects and places for this reclaimed wood to go is some of the interesting parts of managing urban lumber.
Wow, that is really challenging.
Yep.
For the many creative people out there who can use wood as their tool for art expression.
Right. We're trying to see if we can get urban lumber incorporated into new a city has a new development or a new project. We would love to see where there's a requirement to use reclaimed wood within that, or use recycled lumber urban lumber as part of those projects. So having an element of urban lumber within a project would be awesome.
I would like to read more about that. You call it carbon sequestration.
Correct.
Can you spell sequestration?
S-E-Q-U-E-S-T-R-A-T-I-O-N.
Great. That is one of the big things that I want to learn more about after I do this show. Just as a side, we can have trees. We have trees, cell phone trees, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if we had cell phone trees made of lumber?
There you go.
Or at this conference, they have solar panel trees, a wooden trees made out of wood. It's not a live tree, but attaching solar panels to it.
Well, one thing about solar is it does compete with trees in a way. There's a, you know, trees that there's some ordinances or some language that says if a tree grows into where a solar is developed, then the tree loses and the tree has to be removed or cut or reduced away because the solar panel has rights to that sunlight. So it's a little bit of a challenge between solar panels and trees because who gets the sunlight, the tree or the solar panel?
But if it's just wood.
Right, but if the tree itself obscures the sunlight from reaching the solar panel, then there's a little bit of a challenge.
But if it's just wood, it doesn't have leaves.
Oh, that'd be different. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking about dead. Is it right to call it dead wood?
Yeah, it's not living, yeah.
Okay, it's a non-living wood created in the shape of a tree and put solar panels on it. This was an idea from a group from India.
There you go.
Isn't that cool?
It's good use of urban wood.
Oh, this show has been great. It's been a great introduction to urban forests. Michael has covered four areas: choosing the right tree for the right place, planting the tree and getting it established, pruning trees properly, and the role of city tree ordinances. We've not only focused on our own home gardens, but gained a better understanding of trees growing in our public space around us. Michael Pallett, thank you very much for giving up time in your busy schedule to come into the KUCI studio for this interview.
You're very welcome.
Your love for trees is clear, and you give the slogan, "Hug a tree," new meaning. I used to think it only meant staying still if lost. If listeners would like to hear this show again, you can find it in our In the Garden archives on our Orange County Master Gardener website. Go to mgorange at ucanr.edu. This show is called Urban Forest. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, In the Garden Show. This is UC Master Gardener and radio host Ann Liu. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next Thursday at 8:30 a.m. for another green topic. I'd like to close the show with a very famous poem by Joyce Kilmer, "Trees." I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree, a tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the sweet earth's flowing breasts, a tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray, a tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair, upon whose bosom snow has lain, who intimately lives with rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree.
That's a good one.
That's a beautiful poem. Have a wonderful week, listeners, and hope you tune in again next week.